Back in 1965, still another mother cried as her son was sent off to a land called Charlie's Paradise. Billy was a soldier in the bush. He played for keeps. The enemy was all around. Didn't Charlie ever sleep? Ordered up the hill one day to take it and make a stand. Billy never made it back. He was dealt with Charlie's hand. Maybe he's a lucky one, 'cause we still feel the pain of a thousand wounded players who took part in Charlie's game. He's one of a million unsung heroes whose story forever goes untold. He left his soul in arm, but his spirit still is on. He's walking with us on the last patrol. Walking with us on the last patrol.
The Last Patrol Radio Show is a program dedicated to my brothers and sisters who have and to those who are now serving America in the U.S. military, the police and security, firefighters and EMS. This is a Veterans to Veterans ministry. By God's grace, we're here to serve and to help bring the truth to you through the Word and the life of Jesus Christ. I'm Pastor Ted Marshall. I served as a dog man, that is a canine handler, in the U.S. Air Force Security Police in the Vietnam War. I know that the bond we as veterans have is very special, and we can talk to each other. This program is for you and your family. Let us ask for guidance from our Lord to inspire and to hear from Him on how much He loves you. And the peace of God, which transcends all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. Philippians 4:7. The Last Patrol Radio Program is a Talk to Vets ministry, hosting guests from the Christian veterans community and the caring and loving people who bring information, loving gratitude for all of you who are our nation's finest treasure. Here in the home of the brave, you are the brave in that home. You and I have a lot to share on subjects we can learn from. Using the Perfect Operations Planning Manual, the POPM, also known as the Bible. Heart to heart, vet to vet, patriot to patriot, welcome home. The Last Patrol is about realizing that we have a mission that we're being called to. Each of us has a special place in this patrol. We have and are now continuing specialized training for this task and mission. This is a highly motivated and extremely skilled operations team with overpowering strength, courage, and leadership support. The air power as well, the universe knows none is awesome. The ground troops are all in the army of the Lord. We are God's warriors. Who can stand against us? Trust the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding in all your ways. Acknowledge Him and He will make your paths straight. Proverbs 3:5-6. Walk with us on the Last Patrol.
Hi, this is Pastor Ted Marshall with the Last Patrol Radio Show. Today we're doing a live recording here in the beautiful home of Ed Verner. And Ed, we were really pleased with the music and being able to do the show and record some of your music. And it's just a pleasure to be able to come back and see your lovely home and see your wife. It's been a few years.
It's been several years. I appreciate the interest you've shown. And also, I took a listen to one of your shows and got a feel for what you're doing. And I'm real proud of it. And I like it. I'm glad for you, man. You're doing a lot of good work. Also, you did some preliminary stuff that actually replayed some of my songs to your audience, and I appreciate that, man. You're not here to market my music, I know that, but I appreciated that. That was very kind of you. Trust me, I've been interviewed by some folks who, you know, they don't do that kind of work. They really don't. So congratulations on running a good...
Well, thank you, Ed. This has been, I don't know if you know the background of this, but just quickly, this ministry has come up in the last 2 years. It was an opportunity that was presented to me by a radio station manager in the Tampa market with a small Christian radio station. And he was at an event that I was at with the Last Patrol, or Vietnam guys, and they said, we're thinking about doing a show for veterans. Would you be interested? And I've never done radio before.
Mm-hmm. And some of the best people in radio say that. Before they got into it, they say, I've never done radio before.
I've
got a little bit of a cold, so you're going to put up with some coughing, buddy.
I've had no problem, speaking and talking to folks. You know, I've taught, you've known me for years when I was teaching security and the other courses that we taught, but to be able to know that this is going to be in radio is kind of scary. And the second strike is I'm dyslexic. So sometimes I will reverse words or not pronounce things right, mm-hmm. or I may even leave numbers out and say the wrong numbers. So, and I find this at church sometimes. I really prayed about that. I would give out, you know, the wrong verse, mm-hmm. wrong numbers.
Or chapter and verse would be backwards.
Chapter and verse would be backwards. Or whatever. The Lord has really helped me along with this. So he asked me to come to do a demo. I went and did it. They liked what they heard, and they said, we need you to have a song. We need you to have a name for the show. And come in with that, and we'll do a demo. So I asked my buddies in Last Patrol, because we have an introduction song that we play uh-huh. before we do any of our reenactment performances. And they said, yeah, use that. Use the name. Use the Last Patrol. That'd be great.
Mm-hmm. Came it's actually with, a very catchy name.
Yeah. It came in, and the guy liked what we said. First sat down, we did a half-hour show. He said, can you hang around? I said, sure. Well, let's do another half-hour show. Let's do another one. Can you come back tomorrow?
That's fantastic.
So we started recording, and just the Lord just opened it up for us. But, Ed, the reason why I'm here...
I want to say one thing about dyslexics, sure. by the way. I don't know if you know I have a degree in psychology from Duke.
Oh, yes.
It's way back in the days, you know, and I don't practice yes. it. However, I remember learning back then, there's no such thing as a dumb dyslexic. Dyslexia, by its very nature, usually is an upper crust of IQ. You hardly ever have a stupid dyslexic. You have a lot of very, very smart dyslexics.
Would you repeat that so my wife can hear that?
No, it's true. And it's a wonderful truth because mm-hmm. then, you know, like you said, the Lord will use that in strange and mysterious, wonderful ways. There's certain creativity that's unleashed in that different pathways the brain is using and or, you know, the difficulty in reading at a young age, perhaps, depending mm-hmm. on how severe yours was and is, that sometimes creates a different style of learning in a young person that flowers and blossoms into all kinds of creativity that's outside the norm. So I don't know if that worked out that way in your life when you were a young man, but it's very common. You'll see a lot of times inventors, people who think outside the box, people who challenge the norm, not out of malice, not out of a bone for independence and rebellion.
Just the way we think.
It's just yeah. the way your mind works, and it's one of those things, you know, different strokes for different folks. But I've had employees several times who've been mildly dyslexic. Mm-hmm. And frequently, when we're casting around looking for a solution to a problem that seems to be eluding us, frequently it may be the guy that's dyslexic that'll say, well, have you thought about this? And all of us will look at each other and go, and why in the world did we not think of that? What planet are we on? How can we have missed that? And that's something to keep in mind. Whenever you're down about it, or if anybody's giving you guff about it, you just tell them, most dyslexic or dyslexia is usually associated with high IQ. So that's worth what you pay for, buddy.
Well,
but like you say, the next time your wife and you get in an argument,
I say, hey, would you listen to this? And it's such a pleasure to find a man. And I guess I feel like a kindred spirit when I talk to you. And we always have along. And there's something special about we have the same interests when it comes to the ocean, flying, it's things that are just that are part of our life and have been for many years. And I was a scuba instructor. I was a master scuba instructor teaching people how to be a diving instructor.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife became a scuba instructor also with me. It was such a pleasure to be in that environment. Of course, the Air Force, loving aircraft and loving planes. And then, you know, when we met out at Vandenberg Airport. And as I said,
you showed me some of those hangar facilities where I was drooling. I think you were a student pilot at that time.
Yeah, I was trying to get back into it, and mm-hmm. Thank God in Greyhound, the Lord says, "Okay, we're gonna help you here too, because this test is tough." Speaking of tests, you know, before I was ordained as a pastor, I decided that I would take a 3-year course through the Moody Bible Institute,
mm-hmm.
and I was so surprised. I'm not surprised with the Lord, but what he did. I averaged on my test between 94 and 96 was my average test scores. And when I...
On biblical recollection, biblical interpretation?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's an interesting...
My degree is in biblical ministry, and that's what my certificate, master's in, academic master's in biblical ministry. And I would never thought, no way. But I know that the Lord says, I'm going to help you here. Just mm-hmm. listen to me. I'm going to help you. I know how you think.
Mm-hmm.
this new ministry with radio ministry, I know it's leading into some very important things that are happening. Being able to talk to different veterans, being able to talk to patriots, being able to talk to Coast Guard captains like yourself, the sailing captains, which are a rare and unique thing to find, is that people that are achievers, that are inside, there's a patriot in there, and it comes from a bloodline of patriots.
Well, that's kind to say. I know, I'm, for your audience, please know, I did not serve in the armed forces. I'm very grateful to those who do, and I have family members who do, and I've been a longtime supporter of military activities, and I enjoy being able to do my part, but it has not included active service of any kind. Probably, if I had tried to sign up at the age of 18 in 1982, they probably would have had sense enough to tell me no, for one reason or another. But I was college bound, and I was just a garden variety high school kid going off to school. However, you know, back in 1982 was also the year of Officer and a Gentleman coming
yes.
out. And even though that was kind of a brutal film in some ways, to me, it really, really sparked an appreciation for how the military could do wonderful things for so many people in America. And then years later, when I was helping a junior achievement teach briefly as a volunteer in high schools
mm-hmm.
for troubled kids, it was funny, you know, when he would ask the kids, you know, what are you going to do if you grow up? And they would all say, oh, I want to be a football player, I want to be a basketball player, and everything under the sun. And at some point I would say, because I was a volunteer, I could say it. I'd say, for those of you who have rotten parents and don't seem to have a leg up in life, you don't know what in the world you're going to do, I urge you to consider having a conversation with a recruiting officer. Because trust me, if you get accepted to any branch of the military, they will test you. They will find out what you're good at. And they will make you be better at it real quick. Because they don't mess around. They don't waste time and energy. If there's something broken in you, they'll fix it. If there's something you need to be doing, they will find it. And you will wind up being a productive person very quick. Or you'll die trying, one or the other. But it was interesting because in the high schools back then, they were frowning on military service a little bit. It seemed like they were trying to guide young people in all kinds of directions except considering that.
Yeah, that's post-Vietnam. And there was still it took a while for the people here in America to realize that it wasn't the Vietnam veterans' fault.
And I'm sure your show's covered that. You have a lot of Vietnam veterans
sure.
probably who listen, but I know my mom and I were discussing that mm-hmm. a few weeks ago. Even the Korean War really
mm-hmm.
was different than World War II, World War I, but it was beginning to be the first war that was on television, but just barely.
Mm-hmm.
Vietnam was the first television war we ever had.
Yes.
And boy, did it make a big difference in how everything was interpreted. Backbiting the commanders in the field, backbiting operations, backbiting the returning veterans, backbiting the morale of the civilians in America that were supposed to be supporting it. It was a rot. And the more I learn about the television impact on that conflict, it still felt today. But like you say, I think it's come around now. It seems like Americans are more supportive and respectful to the military now, surely than they were in 1975. But I remember clearly, even back in the Chuck Norris movie eras, you know, when he
right.
started doing those movies and
mm-hmm.
the Sylvester Stallone movie.
Right.
Those series that began to, hey, wait a minute. There's a lot of honor here that's been dishonored. And I know you have a lot of veterans probably that listen to your program and or that maybe finding solace in the Lord and in church activities today. But it's kind of a strange thought that how big was the television's impact on how it got that way. Because my uncle served in Korea.
Mm-hmm.
He came back and said, it was nothing like that. And my dad was in World War II, nothing like that. Suddenly, this conflict in the 60s, early 70s, utterly and completely different in every way. And that's kind of a sad thing. I know you had to endure it. I know you well enough to know you were there, you were active, you endured it, both in the field and then upon your return. But I can hardly imagine how rotten that must have been for a couple of years.
Yeah, it stayed rotten for a while. And
mm-hmm.
a lot of guys that still in their heart, it hurts them. It hurts a lot. And that's what I'm trying to reach through my ministry with the radio show. Because you've been around veterans. You know us. That a lot of things we keep inside.
Oh, yeah.
And for many reasons, we don't want to they're all personal. They're all, sometimes they, you know, we have this, we look like the big old mean German Shepherd at the corner, but inside we'd rather play with Frisbee.
Mm-hmm. You know? I had an old man tune my piano. I have a very old piano, but they're all pretty much need the same love and care. About three times a year I like to have my piano tuned. And I had this old man who had been tuning it for 15 years. I'd known him all that time. Never once talked about anything. And one day, in my obtuse inability to pay attention, I finally noticed he had a tattoo on his forearm. And he struck me as the kind of guy who wouldn't have a tattoo, so I realized, oh, that must have been for military service. And then I realized, I did two and two, and I realized he's old enough, he's a World War II vet. He'd never said a word. I asked him, long story short, I asked him, hey, you know, what's the tattoo? Oh, were you in the service? Oh, yeah. He didn't say anything. Oh, really? What branch? Navy. Here's what I uncovered about this guy. He was in the Navy. He was a navigator on a three-crew member Avenger aircraft, carrier dispatch, during World War II, the Pacific Theater. He participated in a one-way suicide mission to sink a Jap carrier off the Bunker Hill. Out of all the guys that went into the lifeboats after they ditched at sea at night in the Japan Sea, not only like 16 of them were picked up, he was one of the ones who survived. Now, keep in mind, I had known this guy in a very good, jovial way. When I finally got it took me to get it forever to get it out of him. I said, look, I'm a pilot. You never told me you flew. This is cool. And he, like you say, never talked about it. In his case, when he came home, he received the Navy Distinguished Flying Cross and several other commendations. He was an unmarried man, no children. His father, when he came home, his father said, son, you've been through some horrible things. The best thing I can tell you is keep it to yourself and move on. Now his children and his grandchildren had no idea that their old man grandfather was this decorated flyer. He wasn't a pilot, he was a navigator. Which back then they navigated by celestial navigation. It's incredible. But when I finally got him to tell me, the next time he came to tune my piano, he brought with him a whole bunch of memorabilia that he had like in a trunk that he'd kept forever. Never touched. An old book about the Bunker Hill, an old book about the captain that was the captain of the boat, his Distinguished Flying Cross, his log books, and several other, and I had them framed and put in a shadow box. And with a little plaque that said, you know, he received his commendation for participating in a one-way mission at night involved with a Japanese carrier, successfully sinking the carrier on such and such a date, whatever. And I said, take this and give this to your daughter. Let her hang it on her wall so your grandchildren will know what you did. And so you should be, I don't want to say proud. Nobody necessarily is proud of wartime service, but it's still, it's an honorable thing.
And it's your family history.
I said, you have a grandchild who has no clue. You're going to die. You're going to be in a box. And they're going to be at the funeral and have no idea. Here, take this. And when I did that, not to give myself any credit, I was happy to do it. He wept for the first time about this whole stuff. I don't think he'd ever spoken of it. He told me he never had. Later on, when his daughter called me a couple of months later, she was like, Dad, I can't believe it. I just learned about my dad. She had no idea. And I remember, well, here's one example. There's got to be a thousand variations on a theme as to why someone would return and not speak of it. It could be personal. It could be things they had to participate in. It could be the sounds and the noise of combat make it traumatic for them. It could be all kinds of things. It could be bad memories, good memories. It could be they just got on a different channel when they were over there and switched back to domestic channel when they came home. I truly don't know.
But I can tell you, as a Vietnam veteran, one of the reasons why we stay quiet about it to other people is because the way we were portrayed. Nobody would listen to us. Nobody trusted us. Everybody said we were crazy. We're going to go climb a tower and shoot people. And this is the way that the news media and all your TV shows and
the broadcast
Ironsides news and everything, you know, said that's another crazy Vietnam veteran did this and did that. And I went to college after I came back, the University of Illinois, and we couldn't stay in the dorm, in the regular dormitories. We were harassed there. So we all got together, and using the GI Bill, we bought an old house and called it Roman numerals XGI on there. And we had about about eight of us living in this little house, and we never went anywhere on the campus without a buddy, without another buddy with us, because we would be back in the corners, they'd be yelling, they'd find out that we're veterans. And I remember one quick incident, we were in the food line, and some of the football players and wrestlers came in and backed me and another buddy up, and we were saying stuff, and we lit into them. And I thought, oh, great, now we're going to be expelled, we're probably going to go to jail. Next thing I know, wrestling coach shows up and says, I'm going to talk to you. So I end up wrestling for her. And it was a great way. And Joe Alger was my buddy's name. He's a big old boy, too. And we ended up wrestling for the University of Illinois. We made the team.
Let's channel some of that kick butt in the right direction. Well, not to say that you were in the wrong direction, but still, that's just so horrible. I was watching one of the, I guess it was First Blood, Sylvester Stallone's first film, about that subject. And there's at the very beginning of the film, there's a scene where he's walking down, and he has on his veteran green jacket.
Yeah.
And it has a flag on the sleeve. And I think the fellow who plays the sheriff, Ryan Dennehy, his line is something to the effect of, you know, you may want to be careful wearing that jacket and that flag around here. It's something to that effect.
Yeah.
And now when people watch that, if they don't remember that time period, they're going to say something. These young people today are going to see that and say, oh, no, that's not, no way. No sheriff is ever going to do that. And no, it was very real back in 1983. There were pockets and places still, 10 years after the conflict, where if you were perceived as a Vietnam vet, that you were a baby killer, or you were a rotten POS, or you were a pothead. There were several different things that were cast on in a horrible discrimination. But the idea that a law enforcement, a local sheriff, or a deputy of a local sheriff's office would say something like that, young people today, when they watch that movie, they feel like that's not realistic. They can't imagine that now. And yet, when I was in high school, I remember it.
Mm-hmm.
It was very much so. And it's so sad. I'm glad that that aspect of it seems to have waned somewhat.
One of the pathways to healing has been getting together with other veterans. Been blessed that here in the state of Florida, we have the largest veterans reunion in the country. And that's in April and May. And that's at Melbourne, Florida. And it's called the Vietnam and All Veterans Reunion. Last year, 87,000 veterans. Now, this just isn't Vietnam veterans. This is all veterans.
Anybody who ever
my
served.
My dad's even been there with me.
Anybody who ever served.
Absolutely. And this started, last year was the 30th year. We've been going there for 25 years. This started as a small, and just got bigger and bigger. And we were there within the first 5 years it started. And we have just seen so much. And of course, us older guys now, the newer guys are in, taking over, they're doing all the hard work and so forth. It's a real blessing to see that.
And there's a lot of people now making short documentary films about particular cases for one reason or another.
Yeah.
And a lot of the human interest stories about various aspects of it now are being done. I watched a short documentary a few weeks ago about a fellow who stumbled on a camera that had some footage on it, I believe, from England during World War II.
I saw that,
And then they wound up digging it up, and they found the guy who was flying the Spitfire. That if one of the film footages shows a Spitfire bellying in, the gear had been trapped in the undercarriage.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a reconnaissance aircraft, apparently. They were taking photographs for the Allied reconnaissance. And anyway, somebody had a home movie of this airplane bellying in on the grass field in England somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the tail number on the airplane and a few other small details, they actually found the guy in Britain who was the pilot. And they set him up in his home, and they stayed there to talk to him about the war, and they just had a few pictures they want to show him. And then they show the footage of his plane bellying in that he did not know existed.
Wow.
And his reaction was like, oh, that's me. And then he talked about the plane and that moment, and he suddenly remembered everything. He remembered all of his buddies' names. He remembered the names of the people he served with, some of them he hadn't been in touch with in 30, 40 years. And he suddenly remembered everything. You know, that click happened where that part of his life had long since been moved away from. But Britain seemed to have a better record of remaining honorable to those who serve than America did through the 60s. the particular decisions. Mm-hmm. I think even in the Korean conflict, it was beginning to be a little different in America. But the Brits never seem to do it the same way. In general, the British people, I think, are better at keeping track of a certain level of honor for those who serve.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they ever went through what America went through in the 70s and 80s, where it was, you know, spitting on people when they came home. And everything. Now, I don't know why that is. America's particularly obtuse and a little dumb about those kind of things, I guess. But and we don't teach our history as well as we used to. I think that's part of it, perhaps.
It's a shame. I've been a guest speaker in Hillsborough County at several of the high schools, and where they were teaching classes on Vietnam and the war. And their textbook is about a paragraph about Vietnam. I came in and I have a presentation I do on the Canine Corps, the history of the Canine Corps, all the way back from World War One all the way up to the present, what the Canine Corps does. And,
cool.
And we've done this as a guest presentation. And I also have a movie that I showed that was called War Dogs, and it's about the history of the Vietnam War, and great documentation, documentary. And Charlie Sheen did the narration.
Did the narration on it?
This is before he was all messed up. But
yeah. I've had to ask you that question.
He starred in the platoon.
Mm-hmm. Well, and his dad was in A Pack of Lips Now, is what I call it, Apocalypse Now.
Yeah.
I meant to ask you, if you don't mind, I want to ask you, I'm curious. As someone who was there, when you see portrayals, both the two main ones mm-hmm. that people talk about are A Pack of Lips Now, which is my funny name for Apocalypse Now, and then the other one, of course, is Platoon.
Yeah.
I'm curious. They both are microcosms in a way.
Yeah.
But were they at all accurate to the people that were there, or are they offensive to the people that were there? Or are they actually a pretty good slice of life for the people who...
I've got to say that the most accurate to me was Platoon.
Mm-hmm.
Because it hit... There's like three divisions of types of people that were serving at that time in Vietnam. Three cliques, as
yeah,
they say.
Yeah, there were like subsets of the social networking.
Got the juicer are the ones that drank a lot of beer.
Right.
Then you got the ones that were potheads. And you got the regular guys that really didn't fit in anywhere but wanted to fit in.
Right.
You know. So that was a pretty good, and of course you had what we called the lifers, the ones that were career military, that were going to stay in the military, that really looked down on anybody.
Right, and they might have had 4 or 5 years in before it started, and they were going to have another 10 in after it's over.
Absolutely.
Right.
But I think that was probably the closest. And I remember the first time I saw it, I happened to be in Los Angeles at one of the premieres that they had, and I was there doing security for the Super Bowl. I was hired by a company called CSC. They have hired me to come to do extra work and help supervise the Super Bowl. And so I was there, and my guys that I brought from Tampa, I brought a team with me from Tampa, said, we're going to go to the movie, we're going to go to the movie. So they all went with me, and not one of them were vets. One was a firefighter, another one was a police officer that was working with me and so forth. So we're sitting through the movie, and I was just sunk right there. I was smelling the smells. I was hearing, it was all coming back. And one part at the very end of the movie, if you remember the movie, where he's just had a big ambush and he's hiding under this thing, and a canine dog is the one that finds him.
Uh-huh.
And I stood up, canine! And I looked around and everyone's looking at me. I sat back down, uh-oh. That's the first time that my guys were ever shown.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And I was so excited. Whoa! It was unexpected.
Well, I'm a movie buff in a lot of ways anyway, but I had seen that movie maybe 6 to 8 times in my mm-hmm. life. But it just so happened one of the times was less than a week ago. So there's quite a few scenes in that movie that hit me differently this time than they had in the past.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the more I've seen or learned about the conflict, I have a lot of pilot buddies that are Vietnam veterans.
Yes.
They either served or they were associated with civilian contractors who were involved. Aircraft maintenance, a lot of support mm-hmm. staff. But several of the pilots I know in this area are former Vietnam vets. And one of them is a river rat guy.
Okay.
And I don't know if he would like that term or not, but that's what we call him
as
a joke.
That's what we call, yep.
But sometimes some of the stories he'll tell. He won't talk about it often, but every now and then if you have just the, you know, that you titrate just the right amount of beers into this guy, and then suddenly
he's around people you can trust.
And I would trust him. I would trust him with my life. You know? So he's a fantastic person. But there's a side to him that you can tell doesn't come out to play very often anymore. But when he was a 19-year-old kid over there on that boat and saw what he saw and did what he had to do, And some of the stories he tells, just jokingly, but after having been around him and some of the other guys in Lakeland for a while, now I recently bumped into that movie Platoon again.
Mm-hmm.
And it hit me a little differently than it did when I was just a college peer. Now I'm watching it, and I'm like, wow. But I'm glad to know that it is not something that in the community that Vietnam veterans who meet in Melbourne you're talking about.
Right.
If you lined them all up and said, show of hands, how many of you want to shoot Oliver Stone for being wrong versus how many of you think he got a lot of things right in that movie? But do you think in general...
I'd say in general, he got a lot of things right.
I'm glad to hear that. Because as the years go by, more and more of the history will be kept by things like that.
Sure.
Unless there's other documentaries made, unless there's YouTube videos, unless there's social media. Because all of these young kids, they don't even read books anymore.
Yeah.
And that's so sad. I do. I've got my
library. Me too.
We're sitting in my library now, and I love my library. I have all my children are very voracious. Well, two out of three of them are voracious readers. But that's rare. You get a kid under 20 now who reads a book.
Unless it's on
them. Yeah. Even the tablet doesn't quite have the same feel.
Doesn't.
You know, there's some of these books here I know.
I don't have to worry about plugging that book in to charge it back up.
I'm a paper guy. I like paper. I even use a pencil here. When I'm doing mixing and mastering, you saw my composition notebook.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's just old paper. And then I'll use a pencil and an eraser.
I'm using an eraser. Oh, my God.
But you got to be careful with that because sometimes the eraser bits will get in between the keys on the keyboard.
Uh-huh.
So there's certain things. You never drink over the keyboard. You never put water near a piano, that kind of thing.
When I came back from Vietnam, I was, before I went to college, before I decided to settle down and go to school, I had something very neat happen, and I had saved my money and bought a Volkswagen camper. I loved to camp.
Oh, you had
a Volkswagen camper. And I had a 72 Volkswagen camper. So
it
was a nice one. You
know? Just dated yourself, buddy. I mean, there's a whole epoch around those things. The VW camper.
It was an awesome little camper, and I bought it brand new, off the showroom floor. I had saved the money to buy it.
Oh, man.
And I brought it back home. My dad went with me to pick it up, to see it with me. And he was a printer,
mm-hmm.
and he had his own printing business. He was self-employed. And he had my uncle said, and I didn't know any ranges, and I've only been home from Vietnam for like 5 or 6 days. And he said, your uncle Jim is going to run the shop for the next 30 days. I know you got about a 30-day leave. Let's pack the camper. And we took off. We went camping in Wisconsin. We went camping all over. Came back down here to Florida, all over the place. And it was a deep impression time. And he opened up to me that he's never opened up before. About his being a frogman and what they did in World War II on the Pacific theater. And we had so much in common.
Mono trip together,
yeah.
And a chance to... Decompress.
Decompress, yeah, absolutely.
That was a great gift. I'm sure there's a lot of people that you probably are dealing with that have troubles or frequently did not have anything remotely like that.
Right.
And their whole life has been kind of this pressure cooker of how do they get it out? How do they express it? And they don't. They internalize it.
Yeah.
And now what? You know, it's like you swallowed a whole bunch of vinegar. You got to either whiz or crap. I mean, vinegar's got to get out.
I gotta say that it really kind of focused me a little bit because when I got out, I was still kind of wild. You know, I was on the edge.
I never lend books because you can lose a friend in a hurry over a lent book. But if I lend you a book, will you bring it back?
I absolutely certainly will.
You're going to get a kick out of this. He actually wrote a subsequent book. But this guy, back in the, I want to say early 70s, he bought and rigged up a van to go on a cross-country trip. And he wrote this book called Blue Highways.
Outstanding.
And then about 30 years later, I don't remember if it's his son or someone related to him, followed on the exact same path.
Oh, my gosh, and took pictures?
And took pictures of those places before and after. So,
that's awesome.
If you don't mind, I want them back. Okay,
you will. You bet.
But there's the route he took. Where was it? And there's the van.
Oh, yeah.
I believe, if I'm not mistaken, the van now resides in some museum somewhere. It was a pretty important thing back in the day. Where was the route?
What was the year that he was...
There's the route he drove.
Okay.
Look at
this. Look at that.
He went up and down the East Coast and the West Coast, across the northern border and across the southern border.
And yeah, we went kind of like this. We went all the way up through here, down through Florida, Texas, and then right back up.
Mm-hmm. You might get, you don't have to read every word, but I'd recommend
it. Oh, I love that.
I'm gonna do that to you. I'm going to ruin you. But somewhere on the line on the internet, I heard about this book. And when I found it, I thought, this is cool. It's all Get Out. So, and I like old highways, and the name of the Blue Highways was in, at the time when interstates were rising in prominence.
Yes.
He purposefully avoided them. He drove on nothing but the old blue-colored highways that were on the Atlas. And it's a really cool series of books. You don't have to read every word.
I will give you a couple of weeks and I'll bring it back to you because I'll read it.
Put, you know, when
I get into something and I read it, I don't put it down.
Occasionally my pilot buddies, some of them, the war guys, were kind of war buffs and we study history. Every now and then somebody will lend me one of those books and I have a habit, because especially out there at the airport, you know, they'll show up and they'll hand it to me and we're in the middle of fixing something on an airport.
Sure.
I'll be like, I'll set it down and then I'll put it in a Ziploc bag with their name on it. Say, okay, this is Bob's book, or this is, you know, Andy's book.
Do you have a library stamp?
No.
I've got it.
I don't mark my books, but you're welcome to enjoy it.
I will remember.
You enjoy it, but when you made that comment, though, you had a VW van that you and your dad took this, you know, life-changing trip on.
Yes.
And it's just, and it makes you wish you could look up the van now. You know, you wonder what junk charges it in.
My wife, she's a fine arts photographer.
Uh-oh.
She has neatest photographs. And now the place is gone. It was up in north of Dave City. It used to be a boneyard for VWs. And she had a picture. She has one now that's in the house, an old VW van, the front of it, with like vines growing out of it. So
right.
It's beautiful. I have to send you the
picture. I like that kind of stuff.
And she has one with like five or six VW vans, all parked in a row, all overgrown.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, here's the title for that. Those That Never Left Woodstock. Which is, oh, I can't do that. So, I mean, it's perfect, you know.
I appreciate that. I wrote a song one time about the first line of which I saw my old car. The idea of the song was that you're driving by and you see in the junkyard the car that you used to have. And it's run down and it's kind of rusty. And you suddenly remember what it was like to be driving that car.
Yes.
What it was like to be a kid full of beer and, you know, putting the hammer down and opening up the quadra jets and hearing that woo-woo sound that they make.
Yep.
But, and that was the point of the song, was this, you know, looking back of that exact kind of feeling. The vines growing through it.
Mm-hmm.
And the cover art I used for that song when I released it was a picture I got of an old beat up 40s model sedan that had exactly what you're talking about. It had like kudzu growing out of it and stuff, and it was all rusty and beat up. And that's one of those things that was fun. But so I can hark back to that. I love that kind of art, even though it's depressing in a way.
Yeah.
You know, when you see decay,
the
American decay, there's times when that can almost be, I don't want to say depressing, it can be soulful.
Yes.
And
perfect example of that is your song, Blending In. I love that song.
You found that on your own. You like that.
It haunts me. I love it. I've been a training buff for years, but I've also, in my travels, I've gone to the small towns and seen the old factories, and I've gone that rail route that you've been on also, and
that's,
seen
it's
how
what
it just
inspired that song.
I know how that used to be those years. That used to be, the train stations were, that's where all the life was. That was the center of town.
Oh, yeah. There's so many ways to look at it, but I wrote that song when I was traveling north on Amtrak, I was going up to Pennsylvania to record. And on the way up, every now and then, you know, most people want to take a picture of the Amish farms and the beautiful lake. And we're going through this industrial area where there used to be such and such Sons Furniture Company, such and such lumber yards, such and such trucking company, and they're all gone. Nothing but boarded up windows, and it was really sad. I know America's still healthy. We have a lot going for us. But seeing that, seeing the decay of that mid-sized Norman Rockwell kind of towns, one right after the other.
Yes.
Graffiti all over the bridges, boarded up windows, you know, or the windows thrown with rocks thrown out of them. And it was just so sad. And that's where that song came from. But actually, I don't know if you saw the YouTube video I did.
Mm-hmm.
I literally, at some point on the way home, I'd been recording. I'd been messing around with a new tuning on the guitar. So I was playing around with a different feel. And on the way back home, the first line came to me. And I actually wrote it down on an Amtrak placemat. I was in a little efficiency compartment.
Yep.
But you could walk down to the dining car and eat. And they had this paper placemat. And on the front says the Amtrak. And on the back, I flipped it over and I actually started writing the first verse. And it occurred to me, no one will get this song unless I give them the visual. So for about 3 hours, on two different times, I sat at the window with my phone on video and just videoed some of what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So when you watch the YouTube video, be advised, except for one little teeny clip, I'm not going to tell you which one, all the video you're seeing was shot by me with my little iPhone. It's wretched, fairly good quality, actually.
That's good.
And I shot it as I was writing the lyrics. So there's this authenticity. I hope it'll make up for a few lackings in my voice. That I appreciate you notice that song, because a lot of folks don't get it, or they don't really want to be made to feel lonesome that way. But seeing that kind of decay, that kind of what used to be a town with 20,000 people, and every father had a job, and every, and I mentioned that in the song. Even the dads were in the front row of the church pew.
Yes.
The idea of families were still together. Small businesses were still thriving. The rails were still being used for transportation of freight and passengers. And everything was hovering around these little teeny depots as we went through going 80 miles an hour. Or, well, they slow down in most of those cities to about 40. But still.
The haunting pictures that I see that remind me is when you go through and there's like an old town center there where you see the old buildings on the side and you see the road going by it. And driving through some of those nowadays and seeing that just brings back. Well, take it for instance, Plant City and what you and your family's done to restore some of those, the building that you guys occupy there, the other places, to see where a community's got together and said, we need to save this. This is part of America that needs to be saved.
And Plant City's not particularly, there's a lot of small towns like Plant City that were former rail route towns that have thrived and survived and kept some sort of sense of identity. But Plant City is peculiarly situated in that when the interstate came through, unlike a lot of former rail hub towns, when the interstate came through, it came through 25, 30 miles away because they had the geography and the flatland to do that. But in Florida, the I-4 corridor is very narrow in several places. You have swamp on either side. And Plant City is one of those towns where when the rail was here, it was US 92, which goes through downtown Plant City. When the interstate came through, which should have really decimated the town and made it slowly become a dead animal, our interstate is only less than 4 miles away from the old rail line, from US 92. And that is unique. You have, so now what became a trucking town rather than a rail freight town. But all of the people used to work and or be associated with brokerage and fruit and, you know, refrigerated cars and all the things we had in rail in the 40s and 50s and 60s, as it became trucking with the interstate system, they didn't have to relocate. So it wasn't like, and if you look at the old Amtrak line, the north-south line, all these soldiers rode, that's the other neat thing about riding the train. You can remember how many military people have ridden the train. But when you had the train route displaced to interstates, you go up and down the east coast of the United States, you can look at old Amtrak lines, and if the interstate is more than 30 miles away, that town will have
done.
Maybe it has a new crop. Maybe, you know, it might have been a tobacco town, or it might have been corn or cotton. But it also was transportation. Now, the transportation gets yanked away, and all you have left is the cotton gin, and suddenly these towns shrivel up, and they really, really suffer. Plant City didn't have that. Lakeland also, strangely enough, was another one. Winter Haven is another one where the train line and the interstate is not too far away from each other. Although, in the case of Winter Haven, you have all those lakes.
Right.
People love lakes. But Plant City doesn't have lakes. So we got one little pond. But that's a nice feature that helps Plant City survive, I think. But I appreciate the thought.
One of the questions I wanted to ask you, you know, pursuing that on Plant City, you are involved right now in preserving photo history.
Yes.
of Plant City and through your also your newspaper.
Two separate things, really. The photo archives started in 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And like a lot of small towns, you know, Plant City had a photographer or two that really had been taking pictures of everybody's wedding, everybody's business, everybody's high school annual, you know what I mean? And these two key photographers in Plant City had gotten older and older and older. And as they died off, no one was digitizing these pictures. And back then, digitizing pictures was a new thing.
Mm-hmm.
In the year 2000, and particularly scanning negatives, black and white negatives,
yeah,
nobody was doing. But now, fast forward to the year 2017, and what happened was we had access to one of those two key photographers had died, and his widow came to me and wondered, because she knew I liked history, and I had decorated
mm-hmm.
one of my buildings with old photos. And she knew I liked pictures,
mm-hmm.
and her dead husband had liked me. We always got along. And she came to me and said, look, I need to sell his pictures. And I didn't have a lot of money for it, but nobody else was offering her anything. And I said, I don't have any idea what's fair, but you tell me, what do you want? And she told me a number, and I said, let me see what I can do, and
mm-hmm.
I bought them. And I created a nonprofit immediately to scan them, try to get the story together. What are
mm-hmm.
the pictures about? We had pictures from the 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s, old football teams, baseball teams, Little League.
Wasn't your picture one of those with a leather helmet on?
I'm just, yeah. Yeah, really. But that, and the photo archives is still alive today. The
mm-hmm.
other key photographer, Miss Jeffcoat, she died in 2012. And by then, we'd been up and running for a decade.
Sure.
And her family also wanted her pictures to come to us. So we wound up now with over 100,000 pictures that we've scanned.
My gosh.
Some of them aren't worth a dime.
Yeah.
But I've learned, and I appreciate, that a lot of small towns have this. And or they used to have a newspaper that had a lot of photographs from their
right, from their archives.
And when a big paper buys them out, they just throw them away. And old chambers of commerce frequently have old pictures
mm-hmm.
of businesses or events or social affairs. And nobody knows what to do with them. So we were trailblazing in a way. Because to my knowledge, we were one of the first to do this. And we love it.
Mm-hmm.
We're still at it. We have a very small staff, but we scan and digitize about 10,000 pictures a year, and then we add them to our database. But
mm-hmm.
if you go down to the photo archives and you say, hey, do you have any pictures of blah? They're searchable now
mm-hmm.
by keyword, sometimes by date, sometimes by the street that it may have been on. You'd be amazed what they can. If it's anywhere within 20 miles of where we are
mm-hmm.
right now, they probably have a picture that would be of interest to you. And if you go down there, you're going to get sucked in. I mean, it's really addictive. Hey.
Thank you,
Doug. Okay, love you, babe.
You want to come teach three four-year-olds with me? There's like 12 of them.
Oh, that'd be great.
Oh, and I might get a sharp stick and poke myself in the eye.
Kids and puppies.
Nothing
better.
Love you, babe.
Good night. Nice seeing you.
Nice seeing you, too.
So I don't want to make it a sales pitch
mm-hmm.
for photo archives.
Please talk about it.
I do know. Like for veterans, one time
mm-hmm.
When we had 2006, I think it was the anniversary of the Normandy invasion.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was, and we decided, you know what, we need to put out the word in Plant City. We want pictures of Plant City veterans. If you served, or if anyone in your family served,
mm-hmm.
even if you weren't from Plant City, if you retired to Plant City from Milwaukee,
mm-hmm.
but if you were active in any form in the military. Bring us your picture, we'll scan it, we'll give it right back to you. And we created a veterans exhibit. We wound up with 700 pictures donated.
Cool.
Vietnam, Korea, World
mm-hmm.
War II. One guy gave us a scrapbook. It was a whole bunch of pictures that had been taken at one of the Holocaust death camps after the liberation
mm-hmm.
of the Allies.
Mm-hmm.
And these were pictures that had never been accessioned into the Smithsonian or anywhere else. They were totally homemade. This guy had a Brownie camera, apparently, and took it with
mm-hmm.
him. And it was in somebody's collection in their basement in Plant. Well, as soon as they know there's a place where you can bring, the pictures will be loved and kind of kept together. And our mission has become, you know, they say a picture's worth 1,000 words.
Mm-hmm.
And now that I've tried to teach children about history, and I realize 1,000 words desperately needs a picture. Because these kids,
they're
visual.
Attention span.
And now, I like to say, our mission at Photo Archives is, look, there's 1,000 words for every picture, And there's a picture for every 1,000 words out there. It's our job to help them find each other.
Oh, like that.
Yeah, because, you know, we've got some pictures, we have no idea what they are. And then we put them out on the internet, and we say, does anybody know who this old windbag is? We've got a picture of somebody, mm-hmm. we don't know who it is. And on social media, oh, I showed that picture to my Aunt Millie, and she says that was blah, blah, who used to date blah, blah, and I think she was from out of town, but blah, blah, and next thing you know,
you get a whole
thing. Yeah, it's like watching as the world turns, a little micro, but we learn so much, and we have dedicated staff, and the people who scan the pictures actually work at the archives, so they remember. So next week, someone else may bring something else in, and there might be connective tissue.
Mm-hmm.
That if you were just hiring these to be scanned, you know, if you send them all up to China somewhere and said, scan them and get them back.
Yeah.
Yes, you saved the picture, but you haven't invested your time and energy in it. So there's no connective tissue. You might as well just be casting salt on, you know, to the air. Whereas if you actually have a dedicated staff, eventually good things happen. And that's what happens at the photo archives. Now, the newspaper was a similar thing
mm-hmm.
in that small town history, small town Plant City's heart and soul, if you will. We always had our own paper until the modern epoch. Eventually they sold out to the Tampa Tribune.
Mm-hmm.
Over the years, Tampa Tribune did a good job running what had been Plant City's paper, but over time, they focused more and more on Tampa.
Sure.
Little old Plant City gets kind of left in the JV squad. You know. And before long, we've become a talent farm for newspapers that want to bring their up-and-comers here. And then they take them to Chicago or take them to New York. I've had for a long time been passionate about small towns that regain their own voice. We don't want Plant City being told what we ought to think or know or how to cover our town by people who care about Tampa more than Plant City. We don't want, no offense to Lakeland, I was born and raised there, but I don't want Lakeland Ledger telling Plant City what our news is. And there was several other investors who joined with me, and we decided, you know what, Plant City ought to have its own paper again. We're getting big enough to where we need one. And it's been a slog.
Mm-hmm.
It really has. People don't believe in news like they used to. They don't believe in paper. And yet we're proving slowly that, you know what, print ads do still work. People still pick up a paper.
Now, is the paper still, is it digitally also?
Yeah, we have it digital. Although, it's funny. You know, Plant City is very young. There's a pretty active social
mm-hmm.
marketing
mm-hmm.
social media world. But we're still printing 12, 14 papers a week. And they're being read.
How many?
14,000.
Okay.
So 12 to 14,000 issues a week.
That's awesome.
And it's free. But it's advertiser-based.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, we run anywhere from 16 to 24 pages, depending on the week and the
mm-hmm.
news. But some things on digital media, yeah, Aunt Millie's in the obituary section. But if you have that Facebook post, hey, here's the Facebook post for Aunt Millie's obituary, that doesn't get shared the same way as if you say, here's a link to her obituary that was printed in the Observer.
Right.
Now the link has a little bit more authenticity to it. It feels a little bit, and in some cases, they may or may not take a picture, and or there may be some news item that winds up being covered in the Observer that lends credibility to a voice from somewhere else that was challenging it. Like recently we had an incident in Plant City where there was a fatal shooting and faraway newspapers were coming into Plant City and bashing our department because we didn't have dash cams. Well, guess what? The other side of that story is most small town law enforcement agencies do not have dash cams. And the reason they don't is because A, they don't get involved in those kind of fatal shootings very often. And B, they have a high level of trust and respect in the community, and there's a good dialogue between
mm-hmm.
the officers and the community they serve. They're not bringing in officers by the thousands every other month and shuffling around new faces every
mm-hmm.
month. And the level of gang presence and violence is different in Plant City. But, you know, St. Pete Times, or maybe not them, but you can pick somebody somewhere from far away, was shooting at Plant City saying, oh, our law enforcement was a bunch of redneck, you know,
mm-hmm.
boondoggles.
Right.
It sure is nice to have an AP-listed newspaper in your own town that has the rest of the story. Here's the quote from the officer who's in charge of the decision why they didn't invest the $12 million for the dash cams. Or how come it is, yes, you can take the picture, but how do you digitally store all that video for how many years to keep it in? And the other side of the story. And I find that's the the thing that makes me get excited about the Observer and the newspaper is, you know, we're barely breaking even, we're just bluffing along. But it's hugely important, the intangible benefits of having your own paper. And every time I travel to one of these towns, like the small towns like Amtrak, and Palmyra, Pennsylvania, a nice little town, it's a suburb of Philadelphia, it's a suburb of, what's the county, Harrisburg, suburb of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And yet, here we are, Palmyra, 50, 60,000 people, and they have a newspaper that was probably 50 pages deep with ads for every carpenter, every plumber, every artisan. And I thought to myself, that man, if they can do it, we've got to do it again. And so we created, at that time, it was a competitor at first, because there was still a paper being printed here from Tempe. There was a paper being printed here from Tampa. And we said, we don't care. Good luck. You know, we're locals, and we believe the locals will support us, and they have. So,
outstanding.
It's been, I'm fighting with it, you know. It's, it's one of those things that, that's a tough business. You ask most of your friends, you know, if you read a paper, and a lot of them are going to say, I don't read the paper. Nobody reads the paper anymore. But they're wrong. There's still people who read the paper. Or they read it on Facebook.
Right.
Or they read it on, you know, somebody Snapchatted or whatever it is.
One of the awesome things I remember as a child is when we moved up from West Palm Beach to...
Hold on one second. Are we prattling on so much that I'm going to get you in trouble?
No.
You sure?
We're fine.
You're going to be able to edit some of this out?
Yes, we'll be able to.
I don't want you to miss out on having the rest of your life. I like talking to you. You and I can jibber-jabber for a long time.
Sure.
But I don't want you to wear out my welcome.
The
I don't want you to let me wear out my welcome with you.
Oh, no. One of the things that I remember growing up when we were over in Melbourne when I was a kid over there is the local newspaper and the old linotype machines.
Mm-hmm.
And if you remember those, and the
seen them, seen the pictures.
Okay. When I saw the guys operating, it was the melted lead and how they would lay the case casing out to do the paper, and I was fascinated with that. And it was being a deliver papers, you know. I did that as a kid. And I wonder. Maybe that's what's wrong. The kids don't have anything they can do. Get out there and do some work. Get out there and bike around the neighborhood and deliver some paper.
It's sad but true. You know, except for babysitting, the only thing that, you know, young girls still get a chance to do is babysitting.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you go to a local church and say, hey, I've got a 12-year-old boy. Anybody got a job for this kid? It's summertime. You know, in the old days, hey, there was somebody doing a concrete project. There was somebody digging a ditch. There was somebody...
pulling weeds, whatever.
There was somebody rebuilding his brother's old car's motor in the backyard, and they needed a grease monkey. But now, sad but true, a lot of those 12 to 14-year-old boy jobs are just gone. It's illegal to hire a kid like that in some cases if you're a business. But if you're just a tree trimming guy, maybe you could take Cousin It with you. And now you're talking chainsaws, and there's only one tree trimming guy. There used to be 20 of them. And lawnmower, you know, mowing the lawn as a kid. Now everybody in all these subdivisions, they all hire professional lawn care people. And nobody hires the 14-year-old kid to push the lawnmower anymore. Did you see the movie Gran Torino with Clint Eastwood?
Yes.
You remember the scene where he gets a hold of this kid, this mowing kid, and at first he's crusty. He doesn't want to deal with him. He keeps calling him Toad and running him off. But later on, at some point, to honorably satisfy his dishonoring the family name, he agrees to take Toad under his wing and put him to work. But he's looking around, what can I do? He makes him clean out the neighbor's gutter, he makes him pull up a tree that would fit in the front yard. But those kind of jobs, most 12-year-olds don't ever see. And I think it's a horrible loss. I'm lucky. I feel good about my children. They seem to have a good head on their shoulders. But I meet a lot of young people that I fear for. It's not that they won't be okay. I have faith. It'll all work out.
They miss something.
But, boy, they're going to have a learning curve. You know, I had hit my thumb with a hammer driving nails at a very young age. I had, you know, handled a power saw. I had unstuck a toilet flush valve. I had, you know, I wasn't exactly Mr. Fix-It, but I could at least do a few things by the time I went out to college. And sad but true, those kind of opportunities for young people now are different. They get involved in sports, it seems like, and they get some leadership and mentoring that way.
Yes.
But in the absence of recreational sports,
what are they doing?
A lot of the other
video games,
or watching, you know, a television series on Netflix, some of which are educational, mm-hmm. but it's like vicarious education. It's not get your hands dirty, you know, change your oil. I don't know. I don't know the answer. I do know that it seems like it's a different epoch. I try to have faith, though. I remember my parents saying the same thing about me.
And
they would talk about how it was when they were kids, and they had no faith that we would ever have any amount to anything. You know?
Had to walk uphill in the snow, barefoot, both ways.
Both ways, yeah. Had to find that fifth corner on the square.
And your music. When did you first? I know you started playing piano at a young age, and. You picked up guitar, and music is an important part of your life. And tell us about the process now. How do you fit the time to write, produce, perform?
Oh boy.
And record.
Well, I'm a lucky guy. First off, in that music was in our house when I was a boy.
Mm-hmm.
So my mother was keen on exposing me to it. She sensed that I could. She had three other children who could play piano a little, but the truth is, she says they kind of just banged on it. And apparently, I was more tender-footed with it, even as like a four-year-old. So at age five, she took me down to this lady to see if she would take me on as a piano student. The lady laughed. She said, "You know, Miss Werner, I don't take students that young." And the story is, my mother tells me that she said, "Take him back with you. Spend a few minutes with him on the piano. If you don't want to teach him, you don't have to." And apparently Miss Batson took me back. I don't even remember this. And about a half hour came back out and said, "Have him here on Mondays." So for whatever reason, I displayed a passion and interest in the piano at a very young age. And Mom facilitated that. And so I grew up with music already in me. She also, in elementary school in Lakeland, they had a band even in elementary school.
Mm-hmm.
So I played clarinet there and was exposed to reed instruments. Later I joined the orchestra and learned cello. And when I went off to college, I taught myself how to play guitar. I'm adequate on guitar. But I'm blessed in that, A, I had it at a very young age, so to me it was just always there.
Mm-hmm.
And I stuck with piano. I took lessons all the way through high school. But I was a boy, so I was totally undisciplined and rotten for a while. But even so, eventually osmosis it worked.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's just, ever since then, it's become an increasing passion that just won't go away. It's like an infection. I laughingly say, a songwriter is not someone who can write a song. A songwriter is someone who can't help but write a song. And that's sort of where I fit in. And I've been writing songs ever since I was about 12. And at first I would just do it as time allowed.
Mm-hmm.
And then as my other careers had some success and I was blessed with a decent amount of security from my parents, so I didn't have a whole lot of debt to deal with after college, and I was able instead to move forward and have a family without those financial pressures that sometimes people mm-hmm. have. And I've always had a piano in the home. All of my children, they were given a chance to learn piano if they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out all three of them wanted it, and they learned like crazy. But with that, that meant I always had a piano in the house. I was always playing. I was able to keep it up. And then as far as becoming more professional about it, if you will. I guess it was 2006 or so when I finally just decided. I had several other hobbies. You mentioned a few, sailing and flying. It just dawned on me. By that time, I had over 200 songs that I'd written. I had recorded a few myself, just monkeying around, but I realized I'm not a sound engineer. I'm adequate now because I've been around people who are really, really good. But they helped me set up a system that I can partner with them now on songs. But I've also been in studios. Back in 2006, I made up my mind. I want to record.
Yeah.
I saved up a little money. I saved up some time. I took a vacation from work for a week or so. And I delved into professional recording of some of my work. And it was just so much fun. I did it. It's laughably fun. It's self-indulgent, you know, in some ways. So a lot of the music I've made may not gather much attention, but occasionally a song will pierce through. And then I've tried to make sure I market it, make sure that I have a web page, make sure that I have it available on iTunes and Amazon.com and all the places where all of the young people go. But every now and then, I'll get a call from, I've got an email from someone in Britain who had found one of my songs and was trying to, he was struggling to digitally download it. He wondered if he could buy a physical copy. I wound up corresponding with this guy from England who liked my music because he'd read a digital magazine that is produced in California that exposes new independent artists.
Mm-hmm.
So the chain of events for those dots to connect for me to sell an album to this guy, it's almost, it's one of those things, it's like a calling. Can't say, I've met a lot of musicians I've collaborated with who do it full-time, professional work.
Mm-hmm.
And we get along well. They compliment my playing. I compliment them. And I frequently ask them, hey, if you can play this piano better than me, please do. I just want to get the song out there. But it's pretty much been shared with me that I play the piano as well enough to perform my own. And I play the guitar well enough to perform my own. So that kind of frees me up. It saves me a little money when I go into the studio. But I also collaborate with musicians from New York and Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., Canada, digitally. And sometimes we'll make music that might have 15 different players on it, 12 of whom have never laid eyes on each other.
That's just...
It's pretty interesting.
It's strange, isn't it?
Yeah.
It really is.
But that's probably a longer answer than you wanted, but that's how I did it. I, at some point, I partitioned off some of my time and energy and money that maybe would have gone to another sailing trip with my wife, or it may have gone to, you know, an upgrade on one of my aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, I just decided I'm going to do this. And that was in 2006, 7.
Mm-hmm.
And now since then, I guess I've professionally recorded and produced, or had produced, I want to say, what, 80-something songs are probably right now on iTunes. Either under Ed Berner or they're under my brand.
Yeah.
Lyrics, Logic, and Lullaby.
Right.
And because not everybody wants to, you know, cares about Ed Berner. I'm just some old guy. But they, when they hear Lyrics, Logic, and Lullabies, that may be more catchy
mm-hmm.
than them. And the other big difference is, of course, I don't really gig. I don't perform out live very often. Sometimes the church will ask me
mm-hmm.
to play something. I have done concerts in the past. I enjoyed doing it.
Sure.
But they were more coffee house style.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to do a concert one day with just myself and maybe a jazz drummer and my favorite guitar player that I collaborate
mm-hmm.
with. That would be fun. It would sound good. But so far, I haven't had to do that kind of thing. And that means...
Whenever you get to that point where you do that, I would love to record that for a live radio show.
Oh, it would be a lot of fun.
That would be neat.
One of the songs I recorded this last time I went to Pennsylvania... We did it differently. I actually asked the drummer and the guitar player if they would stay late one night so that we could all live simultaneously write a song. And I normally don't write songs that way. I normally write them more like Jimmy Webb
yeah.
would, you know, the balladeer piano structure.
Mm-hmm.
And then we hang ornaments on it, you know, all the other decorations on the tree, if you will. But in that case, I said, look, I like you guys enough, and the way you play is... You don't want make me want to vomit, so let's get together, let's have a cup of coffee and stay up all night together and see what happens. And we actually wrote a song that way. That was different. That was a new process for me. I'd never done it that way before. It was fun. But that song came
that's
out.
That's old school. That's where it used to be done.
It was. And we recorded three of the instruments simultaneously, which is a no-no.
Mm-hmm.
You normally try, now in the modern world, they try to set up what's known as a quick track.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the number one way you can rip the soul out of a song in a hurry. Because a piano song is, you know, it comes from the heart. And yet, if you're going
to
collaborate with people electronically,
yeah, it needs to blend in with them.
You almost have to have a perfect beat.
Yeah.
But when you're recording you and the drummer at the same time, you don't need the quick track anymore. You just look at each other. And you nod your head, and he literally can watch my hands. I can see how he's whacking the cymbal, and I can adjust. We can let the song breathe a little. And any time you have a song, in my opinion, that was recorded analog with no click track to where it was free-form in the rhythm,
mm-hmm.
which a lot of jazz trios will do that, and almost all the music you and I grew up loving in the 70s, 60s and 70s, almost all of that was recorded without click. All the Beatles, the Allman Brothers, the Doobie Brothers. I mean, yes, they had very steady rhythms.
Mm-hmm.
They were professionals. But every now and then that song will take just a second before it gives you the next beat.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of it will give you the next beat like a robot, which never most verses. It will give you the next beat like a robot. It never moves. And you see the way that flows?
That flows, yeah.
And I generally like to be a little more freeform. However, when you're collaborating long distance,
mm-hmm.
particularly with a drummer, if you can't record with the drummer to start with, it's really hard to find a drummer who can drum after you on the piano, because a piano is a very powerful instrument. It's very percussive. It really is a percussion instrument. It's just 88 of them. And
I have a confession to tell you. When I was in high school,
mm-hmm.
now this was back during the 60s, from 66 to 70 before I went in the service. This is a real rock and roll era.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of my friends didn't know this. My favorite music was Ramsey Lewis Trio, Dave Brubeck. And I had all his albums. I worked at this grocery store. And I would save up to half my paycheck would go to buy the latest Ramsey Lewis record or the latest Dave Brubeck record.
Do you remember the listening booth stores?
Yes.
Where you could go in, put on the headphones, and they would actually put the vinyl on there and let you listen to it. And before you made the purchase decision, you could actually sample the entire album. But they wanted you in the store that whole time. And, I didn't know if you'd ever been in a listening booth. That's a rare thing.
But that was my favorite. I still have all those records, those Ramsey Lewis records. And
vinyl and turntables are making a comeback.
I see that.
Don't get rid of them.
I'm not.
Do you have them stored properly, vertically?
I hope so. They're in a storage area now. I box them all up and wrap them. I pray to God that they're okay.
I hope they make it. Florida's a pretty torturous environment for some. I have a few old vinyls.
I
have Dan Fogelberg and some of the vinyl from the late 60s, early 70s, right when it was switching to cassettes, which I never did like a whole lot. But once I encountered CDs in the 80s,
it's close to them. Yeah, it's all right.
But the truth is, the vinyl, a lot of my egghead nerd, I call them, the tech heads, the audio files, there's a lot of them who still to this day have never given up on vinyl because in their ears, I call them million-dollar ears.
Mm-hmm.
They have million-dollar ears. They can hear. They can hear things on old vinyl, like orchestra recordings.
Mm-hmm.
Sony used to make orchestra recordings from the Philharmonic.
Yes.
And some of those instrumental orchestration recordings from London and New York, and also Philadelphia. The quality is astounding. No CD, according to them, no CD touches it.
Do you play jazz?
Some of my songs, I would say, are lounge jazz oriented.
Okay.
I have a couple of songs that are that way. And I like it. I don't improvise with other people often enough to where I could say I'm a jazz player.
Right.
But I know I'm technically capable of it.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times, some of my favorite music now, like Jamie Cullum is a young piano playing jazz guy. Every now and then he'll do a record that only has him, a snare drum jazz drummer, and a big thump thump bass guy.
Ranging the three of them.
And the three of them, whenever he cuts a record with those three guys, I'm there. I want it. I just love that guy. But then every now and then he'll do another record where he's trying to make money. So he's pogo sticking, he's jumping up and down and doing all of the stupid crap that music does now. And it just makes me want to, this beautifully intelligent, wonderful, brilliant man is having to pogo stick and jump off the edge of the piano and act like he's a gymnast to keep his audience. Just sit down and play. Play that beautiful music you play. But I can't argue with him. He's won a Grammy and he's a great guy.
Sure.
But still, it's neat to know that about you. That's an interesting surprise.
My dad was having a Christmas party at his house for a little print shop. About 8 or 9 employees. It's a little mid-sized print shop. And he's looking around for records to play for dinner time and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, "Ted, you got any records?" And I said, "Yeah, I got something in my life." So I brought down this stack of all these records, right? And he had just got a contract, a subcontract, from Chess Records to print the album covers. And he looked at these and he says, "Where did you get these?" I said, "Dad, I buy them each week and I work at the grocery store and I'd say, well, buy an album that I can afford. He said, I can get you every one of those records for free. I just got, I'm subcontracted to help print the album covers. What? What? I had to work so hard and I can have some extra money?
Isn't that cool, though? And it's fun, the connective tissues between fathers and sons,
yeah,
and stuff like that. Stuff that's neat. My dad also had, when I was a boy,
mm-hmm,
he and I have always been close. He's still alive, though. 90 years old. I have breakfast with him 3 times a week and lunch,
mm-hmm,
on Thursdays, so I see him about 5-6 times a week.
Yeah, I met your father in the office several years ago.
No, I'm glad. He's still alive. He's on 6 out of 8 cylinders now.
Uh-huh.
But he's still kicking. And he loves music. He has music in his soul.
Mm-hmm.
And I would hopefully argue that I do too. I got it from him, I think. But he loved big band, Glenn Miller.
Yeah.
And so now a lot of times when we used to take road trips or we'd have to drive to do business together, he would always have a collection of music that he'd be popping in,
mm-hmm,
that was frequently big band, or it was some of, he didn't go jazz quite as far. He went big band more. He,
mm-hmm,
was more of a Rat Pack guy, big band.
Right.
But, wow, some of the music he introduced me to. Here I was, a 10-year-old kid.
Sure.
And none of my friends knew who Glenn Miller was, but I did.
Yeah.
I know. You mentioned a jazzy feel. Donzo, I mean, we've had this on all this time. I didn't know if you want me to take a short interlude.
I'd love to.
I could play one of my things that's recent. We're redoing it now.
Okay.
But in my mind, I hear it as a kind of a loungy, jazzy thing. I'm not going to sing it because of my voice right now.
Okay.
But let me just give you a couple of the chords of it because I think it's a cool little jazz piece. And it may be of interest. It may not. I did this song a long time ago. And it was different. But now it's slowly become more, I don't know what would be the word, fuzzy.
I don't want to talk about some of your faith music and your the inspiration, how that inspiration comes to you and how it flows out in that piano. Tell me about that.
I like spirit-based songs. I like songs where you're talking. Most of my lyrics, if you study them hard enough, there's a depth in them somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Frequently, they're about the human condition. They're about love. They're about relationship-oriented things. But occasionally, especially when I put myself in the role of being a father, I kind of had one of my songs more worship-oriented. It's absolutely a worship song. And that was that song, I Was There. And the theme, how that came to me was, preacher and I are very close at that time, and he'd asked me to write a song for the church. One of my good friends is a very good spiritual man. And my wife says he has a halo, and he's just a godly man. He had said, you need to write a worship song. And so I was kind of sitting there thinking, well, I can do that. And then I had a thought about the parallels between, as a father, the idea that I would ever not be there for my child, that I would never not be there for one of my sons or my daughter if they were in need. And of course I would be. And yet young children always ask, oh, gee, Daddy, were you there? Did you see me? Or I fell down and I cried for you.
Yes, yes.
Where were you? And as a child, that thought, that angst of, well, is Daddy really there? But as a parent, it dawned on me how ridiculous that is. If you're any kind of a good parent at all, of course you're there. Of course you will be there. Of course you will rejoice, or you will heal, or you will do everything you can to be a loving father. And it dawned on me that it's spiritually, and in the church, there's so many people that have that exact thought. They wonder about God. You know, something happens in their life, and they think, oh, gee whiz, are you there? And I try to put myself in the mind of this parallel, that how ridiculous it must be to God sometimes. Not that he would judge us for it, but just how laughable it must be for him as a all-knowing father, loving, caring father, creator father, for one of his creation to feebly and with anxiety cry out, are you there? Did you see me when I fell down? Or did you see me when I skinned my knee? And I've tried to write a song about that parallel, about God speaking to us as a child. Of course I'm there. And then the third verse of that one turned into more of a political statement. It was right after the flood had occurred in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
We had the tsunami and thousands of people were injured. It seemed like such a godless time was happening. And so many people of faith were questioning. Politically, there was so many upheavals. There was terrorist bombs exploding. It seemed like nothing but bad news on the news all the time. And the third verse of that song was talking about that feeling of, as a believer, looking out at all this evil, all this badness, all of this death, all these things that are wrong, questioning, gee whiz, God, it must feel, you must have trouble caring, because we seem so lost. We seem like we've lost it. We're not behaving in a righteous, good way. And one of the lines in the song actually says that. It says, sometimes it feels like your boy taught us down here in vain. He told us what to do, and we're not doing it. And the end of that song was meant to be a positive. It changes to a very positive melody. And God is answering back. Sort of like the father to the child who cried, did you see me when I fell down? Yes, I saw you. Yes, I'm here. And I'm not done yet. This is not the end. All of these things we look around and we think of, they're the end. When you fall off your bike and you're a six-year-old kid, it's like the world came to an end.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you are a 25-year-old person who becomes an alcoholic and leaves your wife or gets addicted to drugs or does whatever it is, you think, oh my Lord, the world is coming to an end. But no, it's not the end. And that's why the last verse of that song is, God saying, this is not the end. All these things you think are the end are not the end. I'm still putting crowns on his head.
And that the last vision that I had in that song was literally of Christ's return, as predicted, as foretold, as prophesied. It's a return of a majesty and glory of such that that is an end and a new beginning that we haven't even gotten there yet. And for us to be all upset about a tsunami or to be all upset about a fire or even horrible death and evil and destruction when it happens. Yes, we can be righteously indignant. Yes, we can question. Yes, we can be upset. Welcome to the human condition.
Absolutely.
But don't think it's the end, because it's not the end. And that's why that song, that last part, that this is not the end, if you listen to it, it's supposed to be the voice of God saying that. This is not the end.
We played. It's great that you talked about it, because I was going to ask you about that song in particular.
Well, it was a lot of fun. I wanted to record it,
uh-huh.
And I wrote the sheet music and everything for a full choir at the end, so that it's not just some struggling songwriter trying to be the voice of God.
Yeah.
I wanted the songwriter to be the little, to let that solo voice be the kid crying out. And then I wanted the third verse to be the beginning of more of a corporate worship kind of a scenario with a larger choir. And then at the end, that all that glory, I envisioned the full choir. The angel singing glory, hallelujah, and then God. And we need a really good bass baritone voice for this. With a microphone with a lot of reverb, God. For him to be saying, this is not the end. Choir, glory. And then I'm putting crowns on his head. But it was meant to be a back and forth. And I actually wrote all that out. I tried to stamp it out. But at the church where I was worshiping, their choir, had some limitations.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have time to rehearse with them, but for like 10 minutes before I went out and sang it. So it wound up being just a solo performance. That's why I recorded it later, because I wanted to at least begin to show that.
It's still a work in progress. It still could be dubbed into a...
I'd love to re-tackle that song again. I could write an orchestra part for it as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I look at it as... I tried to present it in a way with some video in case another church anywhere wanted to use it as a worship, for they may have a soloist who could sing it. So I made one video of it that has no male vocal, but it has all the instrumentation on it so that someone else could sing that. But that was where one of my worship songs came from. And in that case, partially a request, partially a specific thing, kind of a little spiritual awakening that I had as a father. And then so often, we refer to God as the Father. And even Jesus referred to him as Father.
Right.
And I like that. And to me, that gives so much hope for people who otherwise just fell down and skinned their knee and they feel like the world came to an end. Guess what, Bubba? Pick it up.
Or they walked by a statue and they were offended.
Mm-hmm. No, don't even get start on that one. Snowflakes.
Oh, my gosh. We live in some very interesting times, and sometimes we need to be able to just sit back. And as we mentioned earlier, just do away with the news media for a little bit. Turn off all that stuff. Find a good book. I know a real good book.
Yeah, there is a good one.
Real good one. It's been around for a while. But get some quiet time. If you have the music, if you have something in the background, or if you have the time where you can really just let your soul take that deep breath, in fighting and wrestling and different things like this, you have a period where you need to get that rest. You need to get that oxygen back in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what this world is running right now. We're running it. We're at the 12th round, which is the championship rounds.
Yeah.
And this is that break before that championship round, and it's all going to change. And we need to really look for that time of rest and the time of recuperation, so we can recharge those batteries and get back.
And that's the other challenge I have too. I try to stay up with modern events, and part of my job is to be engaged in the economy. But I catch myself every now and then reminding myself to have faith. And, faith is everything. You're supposed to have faith around. But, I mean, particularly faith in the face of bad news. When I watch the news, or if I can't help it, if you're on Facebook, if you're on any of these social media things, you know, you're going to see all the negative stuff real quick. It's like everybody's fascinated with the bad stuff. And it's hard not to let that affect you. Pardon me, like you said, you wish you could just turn off the TV for a couple of days and go sailing. Or go be with a few friends and go throw the football in the front yard. But in the absence of that, I always tell myself, hey, wait a minute. If I am trusting anything other than God in this, then I get anxious. If I'm anxious, I by definition am displaying a lack of faith. I'm supposed to be strong in the faith. If God is allowing this, there's a reason. If God is fixing this and I just don't see it yet, there's a reason. But whatever it is, He's in charge and I'm not God. But when I'm anxious about stuff I can't control, I'm actually being a bad servant of faith. I'm displaying to God some sort of fear. And so often in Old and New Testament, the very first thing they always say is, be not afraid, be not afraid, be not afraid. It's almost like it's an insult to God to be afraid. And I think in some ways it is. That's one of the reasons why, like in that song, the end of that song is, yeah, this is not the end. And whatever, in the end, we win.
I was going to say, the question, the ending is, we win.
And we know that as people of faith. And or if for any reason there's a listener out there who doesn't know that, trust me. Read the Bible. Go to Israel. Go visit the holy sites. Go talk to a really devout, good, well thought out, righteous person you know, someone you admire. And you're going to find out real quick. They're not afraid of their eternal future. They may be upset when there's an injustice. They may be upset when something horrible happens, but I look at those people and they're my heroes. They're not afraid to die. They're not afraid to live well. And they're not afraid to pick it up and move on tomorrow, no matter what Facebook said today. And I like those guys. They were very inspiring to me. Anyway, you didn't call on me for a sermon, did you? I'm sorry.
No, this is great.
And that's what that song is about. That song is about that faith in the times of trial.
And I appreciate you reaching out and talking to the folks from your heart. It's hard to find honesty. It's hard to find people that can open up and not feel where they're being exposed or being terrified of what people are going to say about them.
Mm-hmm.
You've known me for a few years, and you know that, fear is something that a lot of people will use, and in the environments where we go into, we see where people fearing each other, the conflicts that we see.
Yeah.
The being able to be a peacemaker in that situation, not in just the security realm, but going in and breaking up the fights.
It happens in the corporate world. It happens in college campuses right now. It's a good sign when you catch yourself being encouraged to fear something by anybody. That's one thing if you're going to be stepping into a pit of rattlesnakes. You want to have a healthy respect for a healthy rattlesnake. But do I fear them? No.
That's called discernment.
but when you catch yourself, and in this modern world right now, the way, there's, I don't want to blame all major media, but let's just pick on them for the moment. If you turn on major media and you find yourself feeling a sense of foreboding about something, somebody somewhere is manipulating you. If they can't convince you that the world will be a better place based on the faith and the goodness of their argument without making you afraid of the outcome, then their argument's not good enough. And that's a sad truth. And, it, you know, it happens in the worship circles, too, a lot as well. Although, in the case of God and His scriptures, there are times when we are encouraged to be not afraid of God, but to be afraid of who we will be without Him. And I think history shows that off.
And where we're going to be without Him.
Yeah. Anyway. That's, well, I catch myself sometimes when I find myself in the presence of negative people or people that are acting out of fear. That they've been made to be afraid of something, whatever it is. And they behave badly. And then they bully, they try to manipulate other people using fear or you know, just the fear of being laughed at. Oh, if you do that, you're just the dumbest person in the world, they'll say. Well, that's using the fear of my being laughed at to try to manipulate me to do what you say. Wait a minute. I'm already laughing at myself as it is.
Hey, you don't wake up one morning and look in the mirror and see his face.
Yeah.
So don't tell me about being self-embarrassed. You know?
As long as God's not laughing at me, I'm all right. You know, the rest of it.
You remember Red Skelton?
Oh, yeah.
And he's always been one of my favorites. And people would say, well, he's always laughing at his own jokes. Or he's having as much fun as the people that are sitting out there listening to him are. And it's coming from his heart.
And a comedian like that gets everybody laughing with him.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, of course, that contagious thing about going to a comedy show. You know, they're a little bit funny at the beginning, but the more people laugh, and suddenly it gets better and better and better. And it's this positive spiral of happiness and laughter. The same thing happens in reverse when you get around people that are negative. It's not to say you shouldn't be around negative people. We should. We should try to help them. We should try to inspire them with our faith and with our strength. But if you're around negative people and it becomes a crowd dynamic and it gets worse and worse and worse and it spirals downward, and a lot of times that's how I feel when I'm channel surfing.
Mm-hmm.
I can pick a channel and just I can tell by the tone of voice in the commentator, are we going downward right now or are we going up? And you can almost tell, 10 seconds or less, based on the music in the background, based on the tone of voice, based on the clothing they're wearing, their posture, how they're looking at the person they're interviewing, you can tell. Is this a positive experience going to get better, or is this a negative experience going to get worse? And I try to challenge myself. If it's negative getting worse, buddy, I have a boat needs sailing.
Mm-hmm.
I have a plane needs flying. I have a song needs writing. I have a kid who needs my attention. How long has it been since I talked to my son or something? But I need to get away from that because that is a really tough challenge. Because so often
the negativity becomes insidious for people. I read something about this, and I saw where they were talking about the negativity, why it attracts people's attention, because people are always on the lookout to be able to hear something if it may affect them. They want to protect themselves.
It's almost like a natural selection.
Absolutely.
Self-preservation issue.
So negativity, if you take a look at news media, that's why they're able to hook people in, because the more negativity that they're doing, the more people are hooked up. Uh-oh, I need to be aware about this. This could happen. If I eat that cereal, there may be a sliver of glass in it, and they found one sliver of glass in 1 million boxes of cereal, and one of 1 million, but that next one could be me, so you start spinning down as you
said. Well, and entertainment's so strange. You know, NASCAR figured that out a long time ago when they had the instant replays. When instant replay was a relatively new thing, and they figured out real quick, if you show the instant replay of the guy going under the checkered flag winning the race, nobody watched. If you show the instant replay of the wreck on the third turn, everybody watch. And it's not like we want to celebrate the injury or the loss of life or the property damage, but there's just something mesmerizing and entertaining about a good fire or a good car wreck or a train wreck. And we're laughing about it, but newspapers and magazines, they exist based on readership and how well they entertain, so that their advertisers get eyeballs to their ads. That's it. Their job is not to educate. It is not to uplift. It is to sell the ads. And that's why it's so hard when you're seeing these television programs. And of course, they're using either sex or they're using scandal to get their ratings. It's hard to blame them because
they're in the business to make money.
Yeah. And human beings, we love watching a good car wreck. And we don't want anybody to get hurt, but we love watching a good car wreck on NASCAR.
No.
And you remember the old days when they used to have demolition derbies?
Yes.
Think how incredible that is. We would get cars together, put them in reverse, and run around bashing them until nothing works anymore.
And yet we lost it.
It was fun.
Yeah.
Like playing football without a helmet.
Now, if we tried to do that today, with the cars made up, the demolition derby would last three minutes.
Morgan and Morgan before the money.com.
Yeah.
But also, because the cars they make there are so plastic. Or
yeah, they'd just all be pieces all over the ground.
Yeah. Anyway, we digress.
Okay.
What else?
We're getting close to pretty much the end of what I had to talk about. We talked about the paper. Tell me about the, give us the name of the newspaper. Tell us about it.
Plant City. Plant City Times and Observer.
Okay.
The Plant City Observer was a locally owned, Plant City only section.
Mm-hmm.
And for several years, the St. Pete Times was also printing a Plant City section.
Okay.
And we did a joint venture with them. They're, in general, a more liberal-oriented newspaper, which normally Plant City would not like. Their section in Plant City was doing horribly because it was very liberal. Meanwhile, our paper was doing great. Rather than compete, we did an unusual joint venture with St. Pete Times, with the Observer Media Group out of Sarasota, who is also our partner,
mm-hmm.
and really the engine behind Plant City Observer. They decided to work with St. Pete. Look, you stop producing a section in Plant City nobody reads, and we will joint venture with you to become the Plant City section. However, you can't tell us what to write. So it's quite possible, for example, now there might be a St. Pete Times article tomorrow
mm-hmm.
endorsing a candidate of one sort or another, but the Plant City Times and Observer might endorse their opponent. There's that much independence of content. It was a groundbreaking thing. The St. Pete Times deserves a lot of credit in realizing when it comes to small, hyper-local news,
mm-hmm.
you can't cover it from St. Pete.
No.
And yet, we can't get some of the advantages that they have in their marketing
mm-hmm.
and in their print costs. So it was actually a nice joint venture that didn't try to micromanage the war, if you will, and yet it did coagulate something.
Well, tell me, is there a Plant City office where you actually have reporters and,
yep.
and people are in there working?
We have dedicated staff that live here in Plant City.
That's awesome.
We have our own publisher.
Uh-huh.
And the layout and all the ad sales and all the distribution
mm-hmm.
for the Plant City Times and Observer is in Plant City. However, if you're a subscriber to the St. Pete Times
mm-hmm.
living in our area on Friday, you will get our section also in the St. Pete Times. So it is unusual. It's groundbreaking.
Yes.
It's a model that I believe could be replicated in other bedroom community,
mm-hmm.
small town, near to major metropolitan area type of papers. But to my knowledge, we were the first. And I did not engineer that deal. But I was very proud of it. I think it's a good model for success.
That's great. That's great. Ed, we enjoyed the time with you today. And I'm looking forward to any time that you've got new music. Please send it to me.
I'll keep you on the mailing list.
On the mailing list.
And I've got a CD for you. We can take it off.
Okay. And it's been a real pleasure. And for those folks that are listening here to the Last Patrol Radio Show, this is one of many that we plan on doing in the future, being able to come and talk to folks live at their studios, at places like this. There was an old show that used to be on, Ed, if you remember, Charles Carroll, that was on CBS. It was he had a show where he would travel around the country just on the road with Charles Carroll, and he would talk about just America, about towns like Plant City, Zephyr Hill, the people, And it was a great show. It was about the background. And that's kind of the way I think this ministry is going to be heading. It's a radio ministry where we're talking not just to veterans but to folks, but we're talking to the heart of this country and being able to get back to maybe some understanding that the people nowadays don't realize it's still out there. There's still a country out here that loves this flag, that loves our veterans, that loves our first responders, our police, our firefighters, and that love their families and suffer when they do, when one of ours fall. As you and I go back, remember I talked about the sheepdogs way back when. And I still have guys today that used to work for me
mm-hmm.
that still stay in contact with me, and they always bring up the sheepdog.
Well, and years later when that movie Sniper came out, did you enjoy the fact that I don't know if that was pirated from some of your training, or maybe it was almost in some areas that conversation that he had with his son at the dinner table. was very similar to...
I saw that and I just went, yeah!
He gets it.
I get it.
But, well, I appreciate your time and interest. So you want to... I can get into some prayer if you'd like, or I don't know
how... I would love that.
I don't know if you'd do that in
the church.
Please
go right ahead. Yes, we can.
Dear Lord, help us to be godly lights and be with Brother Ted and his mission. Be with those listening. If there's anyone out there who doesn't know you, encourage them to find a mentor and to begin that process. Give us faith. Give us courage. Help us to be soldiers that display a calm sense of faith in your will. Be advocates to the Father on our behalf and help us to be godly lights. Please bless this country and may this country learn again how to bless you. In the Lord's name we pray on it.
Amen.